welcome to Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo. I'm Ryan Bickle. On today's show, we're going to talk pollinators, all about our plant, grow, fly program here at Blank Park Zoo that we started several years ago now. And Jessie Lowry is here today. She's our guest, not one of the hosts. So our guest today. And Jessie, why don't you get today's show started?
Thanks, Ryan. I'm Jessie, the Director of Conservation and Research here at the zoo, and I'm excited to talk about pollinators with you, Ryan, because it is springtime here in Iowa. Today, it's a rainy, stormy, cold day, but in between these bouts of rain, we have bits of sunshine. And I don't know about you, Ryan. I know that you've had a couple pollinator gardens over the years, but my yard is leaping into action. There's lots of native plants coming up, and it's really my favorite time of year.
Do dandelions count as native plants?
We're just going to get right into the dandelion. Let's do it. Okay, so dandelions are not native.
No.
And there is really two schools of thought about dandelions. Yeah. One is the very traditional thought that they are weeds and you should spray them and they shouldn't be in your yard. I think, and pollinator conservationists in general think, that first of all, dandelions are never going to go away. They are here to stay. We're never going to eradicate dandelions.
Yeah.
And so why not just let them be? Because they do produce some good sources of nectar for pollinators, especially those early pollinators that we're seeing right now, earlier in the spring. And so why not use less chemicals on your yard, which is also good for pollinators, and let those dandelions grow?
I just have to say my yard is full of non-native plants then.
Good. Yeah. I'm so proud of you. Mine is too. And I just put up a little sign in my front yard from the Good Neighbor Program. That is a program from the University of Northern Iowa called the Good Neighbor Program. You can look it up. And you can get these cute little signs that says either yards for kids or yards for pollinators or yards for wildlife. And then it says at the bottom, no chemical pesticides applied here. And that is because, you know, pesticides are not good for pollinators and they're not good for people. And so we definitely do encourage people to not put those on their yards. That is part of the pollinator story. And so the dandelions are growing, the native plants are growing, the red buds are blooming, and it's time that we're all starting to think about what we want to do with our yards in the summertime. And we had a speaker, Doug Tallamy, who is the author of a very famous book called Bringing Nature Home, and he talks about the American lawn, and all of the lawns put together in the U.S. are larger than all of the national parks put together. And since we are converting landscape in the U.S. At a dizzying pace, we need to look at our yards in a different way. We need to look at our yards in a way that can help the ecosystem and the native wildlife that live here in Iowa and in the Midwest. And that's kind of what Plant, Grow, Fly is all about, asking people to put some of this important habitat back in our yards. And so do you still have a butterfly garden in your yard, Ryan?
I'd like to have one. Mine sort of went away. It sort of got overridden by weeds.
And you did kind of one of those, what I call a pocket prairie, right? Where you had a packet of seeds and you kind of scattered seeds.
I probably didn't do it the right way.
Well, you know, those are very popular and can be successful, but they are a little harder than just buying plugs. Of course, native plant plugs or miniature plants, small plants, are going to be more expensive, but you will have a higher success rate if you do that, because even, you know, expert gardeners, it's hard to see what is a weed and what is that native plant.
I really need to start over in that area.
And
it looked good for a couple of years, but then one species took over.
Do you remember what that was?
I don't know. One species took over, and it only looks good for like a week, and then it looks, you know, unkempt after that.
Yeah, so that is a story that we hear often. And so, you know, once we get to that point in the podcast today talking about maintenance, I'll give you some pointers on how to really avoid that from happening again. You have to keep the weeds down. And some of these species will like to take over. And I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't Black-Eyed Susan. That has a tendency, or asters, has a tendency to do that as well.
Yeah.
Our butterfly garden here at the zoo is being taken over by Black Eyed Susans right now. So let's kind of back up a little bit and give people more of the big story.
Sure.
about pollinators and what you can do to help them thrive. So, Ryan, what would you say? What is a pollinator? How would you describe what is a pollinator? I'm going to put you on the spot.
Well, a pollinator is an insect or a bird or some sort of animal that takes pollen from plants and spreads it around and helps the plants to bloom.
You did a really great job. That was pretty awesome, Ryan. Yeah, any animal that spreads pollen between plants to help them reproduce and thrive. There are also some non-animal pollinators, like wind can be a pollinator. Water can be a pollinator. Of course, here in Iowa, corn is wind pollinated. Soybeans do not require animal pollinators, but their yield will increase when pollinators are present. But a lot of the fruits and veggies and seeds and nuts that we all enjoy are produced by these hardworking insects. Some of the most visible pollinators and what we have really designed Plant Grow Fly around are the butterflies, some of the most beautiful insects in the world, but they're not great at pollination, actually. I like to call them accidental pollinators because they're not actively gathering pollen from the plants, like to bring back to a nest to feed their offspring, like some bees do. Basically, adult butterflies eat nectar, and as they travel from flower to flower drinking nectar, some of the pollen accidentally gets stuck on their legs and wings and accidentally falls off on the next flower. And so that's a pretty cool ecological, you know, mechanism. But if you want to talk about the heavy lifters of pollination, what would you think, Ryan? Who are the heavy lifters of pollination? Yes. And do you think that honeybees or native bees are better at pollinating?
Let's say native bees.
You are right again. Yes, native bees are much more efficient pollinators, and honeybees are not native pollinators. They're from Europe, but of course we are dependent on them now for their pollination services, from everything to apple orchards to almond plantations in the West. And I'm sure many of you have heard and seen the stories about the huge trucks full of honeybees that travel and crisscross the contiguous United States looking for crops to pollinate.
All right.
It's a pretty interesting...
And they also make honey, right?
They also make honey. They do.
Yeah.
Quick tangent. Did you know that most of the honey that you see in grocery stores is not real honey anymore?
Really?
So check the label and make
sure...
It's
artificial, huh?
It's artificial sweeteners and things like that. So check the label. Okay, so we've got butterflies. Bees are the heavy lifters. You can just tell when you look at their body, they're fuzzy all over. Mm-hmm. Some bees have little pollen fanny packs on their legs little pockets to put the pollen in. They do actively gather it to bring back and to feed their offspring. And they are just uniquely suited through evolution to be very good at pollinating plants. But other animals are pollinators too, like you mentioned, like the hummingbird. Mm-hmm. Do you get many hummingbirds to your yard?
I've seen a few.
Okay. Do you know the one species of hummingbird that we have in Iowa?
No, that's too hard for me.
That was a hard one, right?
Yeah.
It's the ruby-throated hummingbird.
Okay.
And of course, when you look at the body of the hummingbird, you can see that they have some really cool special adaptations to get nectar out of long tubular flowers. They've got that nice long beak where they can get right in there into the flower and get the nectar. And hummingbirds also really love red. So plant some red flowers if you want to see these beauties. During the summer, in our backyard in Norwalk, we have a prairie patch that I'll talk more about here in a minute. We see hummingbirds every single day in our butterfly garden. It's just quite a treat. But can you think of any other insects that might be pollinators besides bees and butterflies?
Other insects? Well, flies.
Flies are pollinators. They're responsible for chocolate.
Yeah.
I didn't really envision that this podcast was going to be me quizzing you, but this is kind of fun, actually.
No.
I hope you're having fun, too.
I hope I pass.
Flies are great. They pollinate the chocolate plant. Beetles are great pollinators. The fossil records show that beetles were some of the first pollinators that would pollinate magnolias back in the Jurassic period, which I just love hearing about that. And so lots of animals that we want to support. Of course, do you think that hornets and wasps are pollinators
too? Sure.
So we need to give them a little bit of love, but yes, they are more aggressive. And they're the ones, they're the less like pollinator, I guess, yeah. out of the whole crew. And so pollinators, I know that we have insinuated to this already, but they're extremely important. They're extremely important to us. They pollinate. Do you know about what percentage of our food supply they pollinate?
70%.
Ooh, actually 30%.
30%.
Yes.
That was wrong.
One out of every three bites of food is directly pollinated by an animal pollinator. But you know, sometimes when we talk about environmental problems and conservation, it's you know, we always just talk about how it affects humans, how it affects us. But just because we don't eat all of the plants that that the animal pollinators pollinate, the rest of the animal kingdom does, from songbirds to grizzly bears. 75% of flowering plants require animal pollination. And so you can just think about that 75% of flowering plants. And you can think about how important pollinators are to really the ecosystems globally. And it's super, super important for our economy as well. So do you think that pollinators, do you have any idea why the pollinators are declining, Ryan? Can you give us one or two reasons why we're seeing a disappearance of butterflies and bees?
I know that loss of habitat is one of them.
Yes, loss of habitat. And, you know, we could be talking about rhinos or giraffe or snow leopards when we talk about loss of habitat. It's something that animals around the globe are dealing with as we convert more landscape for our use, for cities and towns and farm fields and agriculture. But also with pollinators, some modern agricultural practices are really harming the pollinators. And mainly we're talking about chemical applications. And so we need to be really careful about chemical applications on agricultural land, but also in our yards and in our gardens, which we'll talk more about in just a few minutes. And disease, parasites, things like that. But out of all of those threats that are happening to pollinators, we thought that the one that was easiest for individuals and schools and businesses and families to help with is the habitat problem. And it really does matter. You know, pollinators need specialized habitats. They need what's called a host plant, and they need nectar plants. And so is it adult butterflies or caterpillars that used host plants?
Caterpillars.
You know, you're right, but it was kind of a trick question. So adult butterflies will find their host plant and lay their eggs, and then the caterpillars will hatch, and that host plant is the only thing that that caterpillar is made to eat. And so, of course, you know what the host plant of the monarch is, right?
Milkweed.
And let's see, I'll give you a hard one. How many species of native milkweed is there in Iowa?
One?
I'm not really sure either, don't quote me on this, but it's probably about 10 or 12.
Oh, okay.
And the monarchs will use every different kind of milkweed. And like I said, that's the only plant that their caterpillar can eat. And so when we're talking about the decline of pollinators, just one example is the monarch has declined 90% in the past two decades. 90% in the past two decades. It is the most recognizable insect in the world. And through Plant Grow Fly and the things that we're talking about today, we can all work together to help make sure that this beauty continues to thrive. And so we're asking people to plant butterfly gardens. We're asking people to plant flowers, just different kinds of flowers than most people are used to planting. And so let's talk about what makes a good butterfly garden. Can you think, Ryan, of a couple things that a good butterfly garden would need?
Well, you need the host and the nectar plants.
Yes, so we need host plants and nectar plants. And when you think of host plants, think of, if you've ever seen a monarch caterpillar on a milkweed plant, which if you haven't, it is the cutest thing ever. I'm sure you can just look it up on YouTube as well. And you can actually hear their crunching jaws, and they're hungry, hungry, hungry. You know, we think of the host plants as the nursery of the garden. And so you might want to put your host plants or the milkweed inside your garden and put all of your nectar plants around the host plants. This will shelter the host plants from wind and rain and predators as well. But of course, we're not just talking about the monarch butterfly. So if we look at our Plant Grow Fly brochures, which all this information is on the zoo's website, plantgrowfly.com, or you can just go blankparkzoo.com, or you can just go to plantgrowfly.com, and it will take you to the same website. And we have a whole list of host plants. And so if you love the butterfly called the American Lady, you should plant Pussy Toes. That is their host plant. If you love the Pearl Crescent and the Silvery Checker Spot, you should plant Asters. And if you love the Southern Dog Face, you should plant Purple Prairie Clover. So it's really neat. If you have a particular butterfly that you really love, you can go and find out what their host plant is and plant it in your garden. And so a lot of insects have only one host plant, like the monarch, but a lot of them have several. And so what we're looking for is looking at our yards in a different way, looking at these plants in a different way, and what kind of ecological services they can provide to these important insects that are so important to us and wildlife in general. So we're going to have host plants in our garden. We're going to have nectar plants in our garden. Should it be in a sunny spot or a shady spot?
I'm going to guess sunny.
Yes. And before we go any further, I like to always say that everything that we're talking about on what makes a good butterfly garden is on a spectrum. And not hardly anyone is going to have a 10 out of 10 butterfly garden and is going to be able to do every single thing exactly perfectly. And so if you have a garden that is part shade, or if you can only have a very small garden, don't let perfection be the enemy of good. Even a small pollinator garden in part shade is going to provide benefits to pollinators. But yes, a sunny spot is best. And when we talk about sunny, we mainly say 6 hours of sun per day. Do you think, Ryan, it's better to have lots of different species of plants or just a couple species of plants?
Probably the more the better.
The more the better is definitely correct. I wish I had a little bell to ring. Maybe next time we'll have a little bell and a little gong for when you get it wrong. No? Yes. So the higher diversity in plant species will lead to a higher diversity in insect species. And I'll give you a little hint. Not just insects are going to use this garden. All the native wildlife that are supposed to be in Iowa are going to find refuge and breeding and feeding habitat and shelter in this garden. But the higher diversity, the better. And do you think it's okay to plant some non-native plants in this garden, Ryan?
I'm going to say that, it's probably okay, but probably not ideal.
I would say that's a really, really good answer. And again, this is a point of discussion that is somewhat controversial to folks at times. And so when you pick your plants, let's just go through the whole process of how you pick your plants. Go to the Blank Park Zoo's website, get your Plant Grow Fly information or your Plant Grow Fly brochures, and we have some of the best plants that are native to the upper Midwest, especially Iowa. We have everything all laid out for you. And most of them, we have a list of nectar plants and a list of host plants. Now, most of them are going to be native, and that is because native plants have evolved to be perfectly well-suited for our soil conditions, our climate conditions, our hot summers, our cold winters, but most importantly, have evolved together with the insect and bird pollinators. And so they have special symbiotic relationships. And so by putting these native plants in, you're going to give them the most nutritious, resources to use. But we do have a couple non-native plants on our list. And that is because, first of all, the non-native plants we have on our list, like cosmos and like zinnias, are not invasive. Ryan, do you know what the word invasive means when we're talking about plants?
Well, I think we were talking about dandelions earlier. And I think we could say that dandelion is an invasive plant. It just sort of takes over.
Yeah, that's a really good, really good example. And so you can have a non-native plant that's not invasive, like cosmos and zinnias, which means it will grow in your garden. It will provide nutrients and nectar for pollinators. Oftentimes, non-native plants might bloom earlier. They might bloom longer. They might bloom later in the season than native plants, but they are not going to invade natural areas. And what I mean by invading natural areas is that it won't spread into adjoining prairies, neighbors' yards, woodlands, and what you have you. And a lot of people, when I explain that, they say, well, I have, for instance, burning bush in my yard. And yes, maybe burning bush is an invasive species, but it's not invasive in my yard. Well, that is actually not correct, because how a burning bush is invasive is a bird will come and eat the berries or the seeds off the bush and then deposit those seeds into the woodlands. And that's how it becomes invasive. And so some really big ones here in Iowa is the burning bush, is the Bradford pear, honeysuckle, mulberry, things like that. So we would never put an invasive species on our plant list, but we do have a couple non-natives that are great for pollinators. And so you go and you pick your plants and you get mostly native. Now, when you're at the greenhouse, Ryan, is there, and you pick up a plant from the shelf, is there anything else that you need to check with the grower about that plant? It's the right kind of plant.
Yes. Perhaps how it was grown, if it was used with certain chemicals or
yes.
not.
Yes. Yeah. There's a big, there's lots of coverage around neonicotinoids, which is a chemical, herbicide. And basically, sometimes it has been added to the plant in a systemic manner, which means it will perhaps be in the plant for the life of the plant. But so it's really great to ask your grower if the plants have been treated with insecticides. We also have a list of places where you can get your plants on our website. Because remember, a pesticide isn't going to just be harmful to pests. It's going to affect butterflies and bees exactly the same way. So always keep that in mind as well. So you've got your chemical-free organic plants that are the right species from your nursery, and you bring them home, you plant them in a nice sunny area of your yard. And sometimes it's good to put, if you get like five of the same species, say like five plugs of coneflower, you could either scatter them throughout the garden to make it look more natural, or you could put them in bunches. And the pollinators really don't care either way. Sometimes the pollinators actually like to have the same species in a bunch, because they'll just have, more efficient foraging.
They're lazier.
They can be lazier and just go to the same flower, the same kind of flower, and get all the nectar that they want out of your garden. Okay, so let's talk about maintenance. Maintenance in a pollinator garden or a native planting, some folks think you don't have to do any maintenance, and it's got kind of a reputation that you just plant it and you go. And it does require less maintenance than exotic gardens like tulips and daffodils and rose bushes that we are more used to seeing in the landscape. But it is not maintenance free. And this is basically how I like to explain it. The first year, and do you know the saying that I'm going to say about 3 years in your pollinator garden? The first year they sleep.
Well, they sleep.
Second year they creep. The third year they leap.
Okay.
And so basically you really need to take care of your pollinator garden for the first 3 years. You need to hand weed. You need to make sure that it doesn't get overly dry. I don't water my native beds very much, except, of course, when you first plant it, you need to water it well. But if it's an overly dry period in the summertime, you do need to plant it. You do need to water it. And then after 3 years, it's what we call established. And what that means is that the prairie plants are so strong, because remember, they're native, they're really used to these conditions. Every 1 foot you see above the ground, there are 3 feet of roots below the ground. And so that's how they can get through those hard periods mm-hmm. in our climate. And so on year three, they should start choking out the annual weeds. Like, I have a bunch of crabgrass that continually tries to invade into the pollinator garden. I've got dandelions. I've got clover. I've got lamb's ear in the garden. And I can already see this early in spring that a lot of those plants are so robust this year that the weeds cannot get in there, which is fantastic.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Why do some prairie areas, do they burn off the prairie area?
Yeah. So because this, all of these plants really evolved to be in the tall grass prairie, which is one of the most biologically diverse areas in the world a few hundred years ago. And that covered Iowa and some of the surrounding states. Now there's less than 1/10 of 1% remaining, but in the time that it evolved, fire was a natural occurrence, as well as bison were a natural occurrence. And so that is folks mimicking what would naturally happen.
I gotcha.
But you don't need to burn your prairie garden in your yard. You can just hand weed it. You can mow it.
It'd be dangerous.
Yes, it would be. you can mow it down if you're having a lot of trouble with annual weeds. And then the annual weeds will, the native plants won't mind being mowed, and they'll just come right back.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's so much more that we could talk about this, and maybe we'll do a part two of the podcast. But basically, go to plantgrowfly.com or blankparkzoo.com. It can be a little garden. You can even add these plants to an existing bed. You can do this on any scale, and it really can be easy. Start small, get your hands dirty, get some of these really special plants that support these hardworking insects, and then you can go back on Plant Grow Fly's website and register it with our project. We'll send you a nifty little certificate in the mail, recognize you on the website, and then you'll receive periodic updates from us. Do you know about how many gardens we have at Plant Grow Fly now, Ryan?
Over 1,000.
Yes, we're over 1,200.
Ooh.
And we're hoping to get to 1,400 by the end of the year. So we hope that you'll get out and about this year and plant for pollinators. And please refrain from putting those chemicals on your lawn and beckon these hardworking insects into your lawn this year. Look on blankparkzoo.com for all the information that you need to know.
And if you want to watch Doug Tallamy's presentation, that's on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/blankparkzoo. And if you want to learn more about what's going on at Blank Park Zoo, head over to our website at blankparkzoo.com. And you can even now at the zoo see the baby rhino. Have you seen the baby rhino yet, Jesse?
Oh, have I seen the baby rhino? She is
very cute.
She
yeah.
is so cute.
And we still have a webcam up of her if you want to. If you can't wait to get out to the zoo, and you can go over to our website and look at her there. Well, that's all the time we have for today, so join us next time for Saving Animals with Blank Park Zoo.